from the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida. It's the Annie Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's May 20th, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet, at least for a few more days. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long. And, you know, happy to report, Chris. I came to this whole rapture thing a little late, you know, because, you know, being agnostic, I don't get the, I'm not on the email list from God.
Right.
To let me know that, you know, he's calling me home on Saturday. I was worried, you know, because you know how much I hate the interwebs and the rumors spread on there and stuff. Yeah. So I had to dig into this a little bit today because, you know, we had our own little mini rapture here. God tried to call your computer home early this week. He got the hard drive. He sucked the hard drive out.
Yep.
But you were able to grab the casing and pull it back down. Unfortunately, the only thing really lost was a day getting the podcast out. But at that point, I'm like, whoa, this stuff's real, man.
I tell you, it's really remarkable how many things just try to interfere with the streak, and we keep batting them out of the park, you know. Now it's God, and we're saying, no, you know, Antiup Nation's more powerful than that. We got to keep going.
You know, I was worried, so I had to do some research on this, Chris. So I'm happy to report to everyone that this will not be our last show. technically, what's going to happen tomorrow is all the good people are going to get, called home.
All right.
Sucked up in that probably big industrial size vacuum cleaner kind of thing. but the rest of us get to hang out here until October 21st. At what point the whole Earth apparently turns into big ball of flames and we die a fiery death then. So mark your calendar. We still have, 5, 6 months left to go.
And if you're Mayan, then we have another year after that.
Oh, that's true.
So in a month. You're on like a month or whatever. So, you know, maybe we should convert to Mayanism so we can last another 13 months.
Mayanism, I like that.
Is that a word?
I like it. Well, it is now.
Okay.
All right. Well, so I wanted to get out of the way because I know we got a lot of emails from people right for Black Friday. Hey, is Antiup going to survive? And we said, yeah, sure. Antiup survives everything. We're like the postal service. And then this whole rapture thing came up. So I just want to be sure to let everybody know that we're going to survive at least until October 21st. And, you know, I think we have time in them because, you know, we just survived this whole computer thing to fireproof the Antiup offices. So quite possibly, we might be the only connection for the people that survived the October 21st inferno.
Can I get like one of those roach tents, but at flame retardant material instead, and just put it over the whole house?
Sure. Hey, we got to do whatever we can here. So
yeah, we can fit that in the budget somehow.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's actually a rapture line on the IRS this year. they're also just calling home all kinds of common sense on TV, aren't they?
Well, you know, it seems like some people think the world would end if they had to show a poker site patch on their clothing on television or something. I don't know if maybe that's all linked to this whole rapture stuff. I don't know. But, you know, I found it interesting that all these shows are basically going off the air because they don't have the money to sponsor them. But, you know, NBC's Heads Up thing is still going, and they have, you know, they have the GoDaddy backing of it, and, you know, I found it interesting that everybody could wear their patches on that show and have no problems, and I'm searching for, because, you know, we talked about the World Series conference call last week, and they're still kind of not really giving you a definitive answer as to what's going on, and I need your help, Scott, because you're a lot smarter than I am, and I'm just trying to figure out what the big deal is. Really, why is it a problem to show a patch or not show a patch or what? I don't know I really can't figure out the problem because the site itself is not illegal. I mean, I don't know. I just don't understand. Can you help me through this? Why it's such a big deal that they're not wanting to show patches on TV?
Yes, absolutely. I can help you with this, Chris.
Thanks, buddy.
Here's the deal. Lawyers make a lot of money.
Yes.
All right. And they make a lot of money because they make things so confusing for the rest of us that we are forced to accept their advice and pay them whatever we have to pay them. So the business model of lawyering is to shoot an email off to your clients and say, hey, hey, there's a problem here.
Okay.
Let me investigate it, and I'll get back to you. And that way they can billow a few more hours.
Yep.
And then they're like, you know what? I'm not so sure about this. It could be a problem. It's probably best that you don't. Therefore, billing more hours because people will be calling the clients and say, hey, how come we can't put our magazines out in your room? and therefore, they can bill even more hours. So that's what's going on here. It's not a lack of common sense because lawyers are smart people. Yeah. It's just they're putting the fear of rapture in us. And I got to say, too, here, I'm not picking on all lawyers out there. There's a lot of good ones out there. I pick on my own kind as well. There's a lot of bad journalists out there.
Right.
So we just got to take the good with the bad, and we all know that. So, and I know all of our good lawyers listening to the show are going, mm-hmm, he's speaking the truth. and know that that I'm not just hating on all lawyers. But that's exactly what's going on here is lawyers are just getting involved, and when they don't understand something, it's probably smart for them just to say, hey, you shouldn't do it, rather than, hey, I don't understand this.
Yeah. I think it's ridiculous. I just can't figure out why they can't figure this out, that it's not a big deal. Anybody can wear any piece of clothing they want. I mean, unless it's, you know, a naked person or something, you know what I mean? Where it's offending, like, FCC or something. I just don't see what the problem is with
Well, passion. Again, I'm not defending them, but, I mean, I think what you have here is you've got... when you see these indictments come down, that's like, you know, rabbit ears go up for all lawyers, you know, because they have to protect their clients, so they got to start looking into it and make sure, hey, is there anything at all that we're doing here that can rope us into this? And so I think that's why it's all happening now. And you know, if you just don't understand, one hand, I think it's lawyers that just don't understand this. On the other side of it is I think that they understand it, but they just don't know – they can't trust that the government or law enforcement understand it.
Mm.
And therefore, it's just safer to tell their client, hey, you know, until we get some directive that clearly lets us know that we're not going to get in trouble for this, it's probably best that we avoid it. And that's unfortunate. And
no,
that's not really
absolutely.
About the lawyers. So.
Absolutely. It's just – I thought it was interesting. NBC did it anyway. So if NBC's doing it, then – you know, everybody else, you think everybody else can, because the NBC lawyers are saying it's okay to run your show and run those patches, then I think, you know, the other shows should be able to do it as well and not just pull all poker broadcasts just because of that. You know, I mean, obviously most of it is because of the funding and stuff, but yeah, it's just real confusing to me. You know, I have a Tricky Dick Richard Nixon t-shirt that I would like to wear on TV someday, but I don't ever want to get, you know, associated with, you know, Whitewater or whatever the hell the Watergate or whatever.
Was, yeah. You're about 20 years off there, buddy, but that's all right.
I'm trying not to date myself, that's all.
We'll work an encyclopedia into the budget with your fireproof Roach Motel.
I think I have one on my computer that we saved this week, so I could probably look it up, but I was just getting my Clinton and Nixon stuff mixed up. I'm sorry.
Happens all the time.
But you know, something came out of this show that I watched, and I haven't really been watching a lot of poker TV. I just haven't been busy. I haven't been enough time. I'm so busy. And but I did see the NBC Heads Up Championship on, and of course, knowing who won kind of makes it less special. But it's something I just can't avoid these days.
Right.
Well, I was listening to the announcers, and there's no real reason they even bring up who they are or whatever, because it's not really their fault. This sort of stuff happened long ago and someone else latched onto it, and now it's just burned into your brain. You know, being announcers ourselves, you and I have talked about this on the show before, where it's just so easy to say something that, you know, when you're looking for something to say and there's really nothing going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's so easy for us to just say, hey, that's Jack Four, they call that the flat tire, you know what I mean? Because it's just so easy, and so some of these cliche things come out, but it's just driving me crazy. And so, you know, lately I've been having a lot of random poker thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And I it's something that I can't really develop into an entire story for the magazine sometimes, or even a whole topic on our show, because, you know, we got a lot of stuff to fit in, and our show has become a little unwieldy sometimes. You know, we're getting to be like 2 hours long a lot, and, you know, it's tough. You know, I don't want people just driving for 3 hours listening to our show. I want them to be able to you know, relax and look at the traffic lights. And but every once in a while, I have a random thought. And whoever came up with this, Scott, when two people have the same hand and their heads up, why does the announcer always feel obligated to say, well, you know, generally, the person who is the most aggressive in this situation takes down the pot? Can you explain that to me, Scott? I mean, let me ask you this. Is there any way in the world that the person who isn't more aggressive is going to take down the pot?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was looking at traffic lights. It's flashing green.
Hey, we're not in Canada.
So cool.
We are not in Canada.
No, I hear what you're saying. And I don't have a good answer for this.
If they check it down, they tie. If one guy bets, he's obviously more aggressive than the other person because he won the pot. And if the other guy re-raises, obviously he's more – I mean, it makes no sense. It's something that's so obvious that it really shouldn't be said. And it just drives me crazy. And who's – all of these things that people say, you know, oh, it's a classic race situation. Who came up with this first? I want to know. And why are people still saying stuff like this?
Well, because we're all lemmings. We catch on to something, and we just have to, you know, be part of the cool kids and say it. So
generally, when Chris makes a comment, Scott will make a funnier comment in this situation. That's why I was hoping. You know what I mean? It's just every once in a while I have random thoughts. Like, poker is like being a cop. You have to look out for the thieves. And, you know, but really, there's no story there. I can't really develop a whole story in these random thoughts that I have. But it's true. I mean, you got to watch out for people stealing. And, you know, and you got to, you know, like our good friend Joe Navarro, he was an ex-cop or FBI guy. And he, you know, he you got to look at them and know whether they're telling the truth in poker. It's the same when you're a cop, and do you let this guy go because you believe him, or, you know, so there's some random thoughts always popping in my head while we're doing the show, but I don't know if I should just blurt them out or not. So I think I might you might be in the middle of an idea someday, Scott, and I might just go, you know, poker rhymes with Joker, you know, I mean, I may just throw that out there and see what you say. You know?
Excellent. I think that's going to be exactly what we need to keep these shows unwieldy.
Yeah, unwieldy and fresh. Keep them going.
Going off script. Yep.
Trying to get to 3 hours is what I'm doing. I'm trying to get the show to 3 hours so you and I can spend 6 or 7 hours a week doing the show. Well, but really, I watched the heads up thing, and that was like the first thing that they said when I tuned in. And I thought, oh my God, why am I watching online? Why am I watching TV on poker or whatever on TV? I don't know. Just drive me crazy. So anyway, from now on, random thoughts could just come out. I might have poker Tourette's, and you're going to have to deal with it.
Well, you know, the good thing, though, Chris, is that our 2 hours are solid.
Yeah.
Solid good 2 hours, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Unlike this abomination that on TV called the $1 million money drop, which is really about a 30-minute show in an hour package. Have you watched this thing?
I watched it when it debuted, like, months ago, and then
It hasn't been on for a while, but, you know, we got through a couple of them, and then the better stuff came on TV, which is not hard to find. And so we just got around to finally finishing them off this week. And first, I got to say, you know, if we create an Annie Up game show, I'm going to go against type and actually get smart people on it.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a market that's untapped, smart people on game shows.
Especially, like, I always watch those shows and think, how would, you know, Skolansky do on these shows? I always wonder that, like, especially that 1 versus 100 and this show in particular, you know, the odds and everything. I would love to see smart people on this show.
And I promise our listeners I'm getting to a poker point here in a minute. But
well, I tried to reel it in for you and say Skolansky, so at least they could hear Skolansky go, exactly. Hey, poker!
Right. But I got to mention this because I just haven't anybody else to talk about. I was catching up, and a beautiful young wife and her Marine husband, cute couple. I'm sure they're going to have a gajillion cute kids and stuff, and they're on there, and they're all bouncing around excited, you know, like the other contestants would be, right? And they get the choice between the two categories, right?
Yep.
And they go, ooh, coins. Oh, I like coins. Coins are good. Yeah, you know, kids always want coins. So, all right, well, let's go with coins. All right, so they go with coins. I don't even know what the other one was. You know, it could be Disney. It could have been snack food. Something. All right. But they decided between this and the other one, it wasn't like, all right, coins is lesser of the two evils. We don't know anything about either one. We'll take coins. They were enthusiastic about picking the coin question, right?
Right.
The question was, who appears on the dime?
Right.
All right, and for folks that don't watch this, they got four answers, and they got to take their $1 million and spread it out between the four. And then, you know, if they're wrong, that money goes whoosh down the chute, and it's gone forever, right?
Yep.
And the money that stays on the correct answer, they get to keep, and they move on until they get all seven questions, which I don't know if anybody's ever done it. But,
yeah, you have to go to the end, too.
Right.
You can't just stop and say, I'll take that money.
You know, the concept of the show is good, except they had to dig Kevin Pollak out of whatever grave he's been in to be the host. And so, you know, they picked who's on the dime, right? And, and I sit there and I start laughing on the couch, and I'm like, you got to be kidding me. This is the second question? This isn't even worthy of the first question. Who doesn't know who's on the freaking dime? I mean, this is one of those free pass questions.
Stoyle Brunson.
Well, yeah, as far as these two people are, that would have been a better answer.
I'm trying to tie it back to poker, that's all.
Yeah, and they start talking, and, which, you know, my wife keeps yelling at me. She keeps throwing at me things when I watch the show. They tell them to talk it out, Scott! And I'm like, yeah, I know they tell them to talk it out, but geez, Roosevelt's on the dime!
Yeah.
And then the wife was like, no, it's got to be Lincoln. Lincoln's on the dime.
Who said that?
The wife, I think.
Oh, not your wife.
No, the wife on the show.
Okay, because I'm like, wait, because I thought you were talking about your wife, too, a little bit in there, and I wasn't sure. I was getting lost.
Yeah.
I was looking at traffic lights, so I'm sorry.
Yeah. So they put all $1 million on Lincoln.
Oh, no.
And gone.
Oh, are you kidding me?
And they just look like somebody just ran over their puppies. And I'm like, you know, I can't help you for being a moron. Has our universe got to this point where people don't even use coins enough that they forget who's on them?
Oh, my God. So, let's see. Lincoln is on, like, the penny, the $5 bill, and the dime? I don't think so.
Yeah. Yeah, crazy. All right, so that was just me ranting there. All right, so here's the poker thing, though. So, I'm sitting here, because obviously you have a lot of time to think about other things watching this show.
Yeah.
Because these idiots have to talk it all out and then take their once a show quick change or whatever, and... the next couple on there were two guys, and very enthusiastic, blah, 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 blah. And they got down close to the end. They actually made it to the seventh question, Chris.
Wow.
They made it to the seventh question with $40,000 left.
Of course.
Because what happened was, at one point, they're like, ooh, shouldn't we hedge the bet? Shouldn't we put a little bit on this just so in case we're still alive? And the other guy goes, yeah, that's a great idea. Put $40,000 on that one. Well, it turned out to be a good idea because they were wrong.
Yeah.
And they got to keep the $40,000, right?
Yeah.
But I was sitting there thinking, I'm breaking the TV. I'm through seven TVs watching the show, just throwing things at it. I'm like, the object of this game, folks, isn't to get to question seven. The object of this game is to win as much money as possible.
Right.
So then I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, this is exactly like poker. I mean, how many times on the show or things people say, oh, man, I wanted to win that pot. All right, well, it's not about winning the pot. It's about winning the most money. I would rather go in a poker room, sit there for 8 hours, win one $10,000 pot, than sit there for 8 hours and win 100 pots and walk out of there with $5,000. But our wiring is, hey, I've got to win.
Yeah.
Or I've got to stay alive. I got to stay alive.
Now, this is weird because, I know that like 45 guys are going to just totally bombard you with emails after that statement. But you're like a short stack ninja. And to me, for you to say that you want to just do it all in one big pot instead of sticking around and hanging around doesn't make sense to me because you're the guy that always wants to, you know, hang around and get it in good rather than... Well, I mean, I guess it's kind of the same thinking because you're like stick around for all day to win one $10,000 pot. But really, I mean, when you're in a tournament, to me, you're not getting it all in and trying to win a big pot. You're the one that's like, well, I can still fold here with ace queen suited to a, you know, with one big bet to a blind raise from the button. I can still fold this and play and get in a better spot. And so I'm kind of confused by your thinking.
Well, just wait till we get to the hand of the week, because then I'll further confuse you.
Oh,
because
geez.
It's a classic short stack ninja situation in our hand of the week today.
Oh, man.
We're looking forward to it. But no, you're right. You're right to be a little, I think I'm a little schizo here. And there are weaknesses in my argument.
Oh, well, I wasn't trying to point out weaknesses. I just
And I'm working on that kind of thing. But this is a little different situation, I think. This is kind of like neutering yourself just to stay alive. Whereas the short stack ninja is you've already either made a mistake or got unlucky and found yourself in this precarious situation. So now are you trying to still win the tournament against all odds or just try to limp your way into the money and then hope for the best? That's a different situation in my mind. Of course, my mind is crazier than most people's.
Well, if I were to take your analogy or at least this show's example and put you in a tournament and say to you, okay, Scott, it's a race. You're going to have ace-king. He's going to have queens. And it's a classic race because we pointed that out already.
I've heard that.
And what I'm going to say to you is, okay, you can put...
Did you coin that term?
All of your chips in the middle. But if you want, I can let you hold back 10 big blinds and still get away with it. Are you going to do it? And then if you say yes, then your whole argument's blown.
No, that's not true. Because you're...
You didn't say yes or no.
Yeah, because you haven't fully explained the rules of the game here. Is this a one and done? This is the only shot I have?
Well, at this point, it is for them.
Another hand
you said,
after that.
I'm comparing that last moment with them. That last moment with them was, let's put it all on this one. And then one guy said, let's hedge our bets, put 40 grand over here. And he did it, and you told him that's wrong. So what I'm saying to you is, you put it all in... And I walk by as a tournament director and say, hey, you know what, Scott? You're so special. You're the publisher of a magazine. I'm going to tell you right now, you can take 10 big blinds out of that and still have the race this guy and knock him out and not have to worry about, you know. Would you do it if you could, if it was in the rules?
Well, I get what you're getting at, but it's a different situation. Because what the reason they put the 40,000 is was purely to stay alive. You're like, hey, you know, we want to extend our 15 minutes of fame to 16 minutes here. And if we put it all on this one thing and we're wrong, then we're off the show and the next few couples on, they're bouncing around. It had nothing to do with money to them at that point. They just wanted to stay alive.
Well, they know that if they can get to – which the next one was question 7, right?
It might have been 7.
That they have one more chance to get to get at least some money in their pocket. I mean, staying alive still means money in this thing, right? Staying alive means money, so I don't know if I necessarily agree with you that they just wanted to get stay on the show to be cute on TV. I feel like they still needed to get money, and the only way they can get money to ensure they were going to get money or to get a chance to win money was to have some money on the other choice. But again, I'm not watching the show, so I don't really know.
But if that's the point too, I mean, you don't put like a little lifesaver 40,000 there. Right. You actually hedge the bet.
Right. So you would like split it.
Well, you know, we're getting the hyperbole here over this actual
right.
situation. I don't remember what the question was or anything, but yeah, I mean, I guess so. I mean, you know, if they were just trying to survive, if they're trying to get money, the best thing would have done, or if you're taking a blanket question where you don't know the question or the answer, let's just say there's 4 drops, all right?
Yeah.
That's all the game is. And you tell somebody, hey, here, you've got $1 million. You got to spread it on 3 of them. You got to leave 1 blank. The natural thing to do would be to put $333,333 on all 3 of them and leave 1 blank.
Right.
Unless you're a complete gambler.
Right.
Say, hey, you know what? We're going to put it all on the same.
I mean, unless you're absolutely 100% sure of the answer. But yeah.
Right. And so I guess that's the point here is if they're sure they just want to get to question 7 and profit from it, the best thing would be to put $500,000 on one, $500,000 on the other. That way. They still survive and still have a lot of money.
Right.
They may not have as much money as if they put it all on the other one. So, I don't know. It just seemed weird.
Okay. Well, random thought. Let's say Obama decides that poker really is a good thing and decides it's such a good thing that he wants to change our money and have poker players on the money instead.
Yeah,
Who would you put on each of the currency? And I'm opening up this at Anti-Up Nation. I'm not asking you right now because I don't want the show really to be 3 hours. I just joke. But that's an interesting thing. Like, who would be on the dollar bill? It'd have to be Doyle Brunson, right? Because, you know.
Let's do that. We'll make that part of a future show.
Yeah.
And we'll see what our listeners came up with. I like it.
Yeah, I mean,
are we talking coins or just bills?
No, let's just do bills. Yeah,
yeah, because we don't use coins except for those annoying rooms that actually make you use quarters. I hate that.
Right, and we already know that Lincoln's on the penny and a dime, so we don't need to have anybody.
That's right. We don't want to confuse that poor woman anymore than she already is. All right. So just the bills. So,
just the bills.
1, 5, 10, 20, 50, and 100. Right.
Right, and then for our international listeners. You know, you can still play along. It has nothing to do with your money.
Yeah.
It's just money.
No, we can make it international. Yeah, let us know what needs to go on the euro.
Yeah. All right, that's cool. And then, you know, if there's anybody you want to put on the yen, that's fine too. Whatever. Johnny Chan, maybe? I don't know.
Oh, boy. Had to go there, didn't you?
Well, he's from China.
I know, but it doesn't mean he has to be on the yen.
No,
he's got a $100 bill.
I thought it'd be more accepting over there because they're strict. All right, our mailbag comes from Michael Cantor. He's been on our show a few times.
Yeah, great guy.
And he said he recently got back from Vegas, and he wants to know, what's up with all the fake politeness, man? Why are everybody so phony? He's like, he sat down a 1-2 game at the Venetian, and not only did the dealer welcome him, which is standard. I mean, that's supposed to happen. They want them to be friendly.
Right.
But then he says, a kid two to his right, and then he like describes what he looks like, which I don't really think that really matters. But he says, he says in a cheery voice, "Welcome to the table, sir." He says, "I refrain from making an obnoxious comment back to him, but where does all this sir stuff come from?" He can understand a hi, or how you doing, or some kind of normal greeting, but he felt that was a little over the top. He says, "When I beat somebody in basketball, I don't say nice game, sir." He wants to know, is it the Southern influence with all those guys from Texas getting poker popular, or, you know, is the gentleman gambler image? What's the deal?
Well, I got to say, I wrote right back, and I was a little mortified.
Mortified.
And I'm like, yo, Mike, I'm sorry, dude. I say sir or ma'am all the time, and I don't mean anything pretentious or hipsterish or whatever it is about it.
Hipsterous.
It would have never occurred to me that anybody would have taken offense to being called sir or ma'am until now, and it's opened my eyes up. I'm not going to change, I don't think, but at least now when somebody flicks a card through my skull for calling them sir, I'll know that there are people out there that find it fake.
unless they can hear the tone of the voice, he said it was cheery, so... I mean, what's wrong with it? Michael, what is wrong with you, man? Relax, dude. You must be from Jersey, as they say.
Yeah, I think he wrote back to say he was from the Northeast. And I'm like, oh, okay, I get it. All right.
Well, being from there, that's all I used to hear.
Oh, you got being polite, so.
When I first moved here, man, I used to hear guys say that all the time. You must be from New York, or you must be from Jersey. And I'm like,
it's not hard to pick you guys out.
Yeah. So. But really, I mean, calm down, dude. It's okay. It's nice to have people be nice to you. He's not ulterior motive. He's not stealing from you.
Well, I thought about this a little bit more, too, and I was trying to figure out why I started saying sir, ma'am. It wasn't anything purposeful. I mean, I wrote it back, and I'm like, you know what? I really think it goes back to my mom, who kind of taught me to be really polite. And then, it just kind of stuck.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know. I mean, if somebody's older than me, I'm showing respect. If they're my age or younger, if I say sir, it's just, I'm being funny or something. You know what I mean? So, Michael, if you were older than this guy,
yeah, I guess that's
respectful.
The problem. He thought you were being funny. And he was like, hey, take your clown show on the road there, Cosenza. Whereas other people like me are trying just to be polite, and even though I guess it's not standard.
So, men, the master is like, when he says, nice hand, sir, then he's being a jerk then, I guess is what you're saying.
Well, according to you and Mike.
Michael Cantor, yeah. All right. Well, whatever. I don't know if it's a Southern influence thing. I think it's just a matter of either he's being polite or he's just making a joke. And I think Michael needs to lighten up.
Yeah, I'd be a lot worse if I sat there and I'm like, hey, nice game, Jackwad.
You're only buying it for the minimum? What a nit. Welcome to the table.
Welcome to the game, Ass Jacket.
Ass Jacket.
That I would be offended by. But welcome to the table, sir. I'm missing it.
Ass Jacket underwear?
Is there?
No, isn't it underwear when you say Ass Jacket? I mean, an Ass Jacket I would think would be like underwear or something.
Oh, I don't know. I never thought about it
that
way.
So you're calling somebody underwear. Welcome to the table, underwear. Welcome to the table, Fruit of the Loom.
That would be funnier. Yeah. Well, I had a Fruit of the Loom. Now you're taking it too far, but...
So
maybe we should start saying welcome to the table and just forget about the... that's the problem here, right?
Yeah.
is we're adding too many words to the greeting. We just keep it simple. Hi, put our heads down and don't engage in people. We won't offend them.
I don't say anything. Just sit there and play. Who cares? Whenever somebody joins an online table, when you were playing online in the good old days, did you be like, hey, welcome to the table? No, you just played and took his money. Who cares? Don't be social. Just take their money. Because remember what Scott said, you're playing for money, not pots. So you're playing for money, not to be social.
All right, Mike, you know the drill. You've been on the show before, too. And even if you weren't, I'd be rude enough to not send you a spy.
Nice mail back, sir.
But everybody else, email us at podcast@annieupmagazine.com. And if we use your item on the show and we haven't sent you swag before, we'll be happy to send you a something like the deck of J Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Ante Up, now available in the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com.
Our hotline is 813-448-1120. If you call it and we use it, we'll give you something cool if it's the first time you've called us. This one comes from Devin in Georgia.
Hey, Scott, Chris, this is Devin from Dallas, Georgia. I was just giving you a call to let you know about a hand I played. I was in Jacksonville 2 weekends ago and went to Orange Park Kennel Club and played at the poker room. And I picked up a hand where I had 2 sevens. I bet $16 into a pot. I was playing the 2-2 no limit. I bet $16 and was called by two players. I was actually right after the button. I was first to act. And I bet $16 after everybody called their $2. It got everybody out but two players. And the flop come Jack, Queen, Jack, and I followed out and bet $20 into the pot. And everybody got out of the way but this one guy that was right behind me on the blinds. On the turn, I checked to him, and he looked back at me, and I just felt like he was either really strong or he was chasing really, really bad. So I checked to him, and he looked back and checked to me. On the river, a random card came out, a 2 or a 3, I'm not really sure. And I bet just $15 into the pot, as big as the pot was, and he folded kings face up. Of course, I mucked my cards, and I felt like that I was ahead, but undoubtedly, he made a bad fold. What do you guys think about this?
You know what? I'm pretty sure he was playing against Phil Locke. I don't know if you see, you don't really watch as much as I do, but I mean, yeah. I have literally seen Phil Locke lay down kings to like any kind of bet. Whenever somebody raises and then he calls and they re-raise or something and he has kings, somebody breathes on the pot, he folds kings so fast, it's like you can't even see him do it. It's a blur.
Yeah.
That's pretty weird, though. That is kind of especially for a nominal bet on the river.
Well, you know, I guess what I'm thinking is, our hero here made a pretty big bet from the small blind, which is the worst position. And should telegraph to people, hey, I've got a real hand. No, of course, it doesn't mean you have a real hand, but should telegraph that, right?
Yeah.
And then it made another big bet on the flop. The turn made it a little dangerous there. So, I don't know, maybe the guy was just messing around and said, you know what, hey, man, this guy's messing with me, and it's not worth it.
Yeah. Just a small bet on the river, though. The other two bets, sure, they might have been something that could discourage him, but a check on the turn, then a small bet on the river, I mean, you know, you got to see what the guy has, see how he plays, and... Wow, that's bizarre. That is bizarre. But hey, he might have gotten some advertising out of showing the kings and then, you know, paid off later or something.
Or maybe the villain here had heard this podcast and said, you know what? I'm not here to win pots. I'm here to win money. I'm going to save this money now. I'm not going to put a little chink in my little pot tally going on here. And I'm going to win more money later on. That's probably what happened.
Okay, so you're telling me he has the hot tub time machine. Listened to this show before the world ended, by the way.
Yes.
And then went back in time and then
very
played this game accordingly.
Very precarious navigation there. Yeah, they got very good GPSs in the future.
All right, very good. Terminator 2 is at my table, apparently.
All right, Devin, we appreciate you calling. We're going to send you a download of Poker Hand and Breakdown Pro and Hand History Analysis Program for single or our mixed games. That comes from our great friends at element26.net.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the thing, too, is you got to remember, you can take those hand histories and put them in there and you can still learn from stuff like that, even if you're not playing online right now. So it's
absolutely
a good thing to have.
All right, our call to the floor is back, and boy, we've been getting inundated with this.
Yeah, it's
maybe
good.
Maybe it's because everybody's navigated from online where they don't have any floor problems to playing live now, and all of a sudden everybody's going, WTF, what's going on? People make mistakes. How's that happening? We should punish them.
Why are my bets not being posted automatically?
So, yeah, we're getting a lot now. So, and our good friend Jody Russell is answering them lightning fast now. So, I'll go ahead and read this week's.
Go ahead.
All right. Comes from MCO Mikey. He's been on the show a couple times, too. He posted this in our forum. Remember, we do have the Call the Floor thread on our forum at anyupmagazine.com/forum where you can post them there. And here's what he said. He said he's in a 1-2 no limit hold'em game. He said a player open for $8 gets 4 callers. $41 is in the pot. Flop now is 3-4-4. Player bets $20 and the button calls. All right?
Yep.
Dealer scoops up the flop and mucks the cards.
Oh, no.
And later says he did not see the call. I'm sure that was later, as in the second after, when everybody's like, hey, what are you doing? Floor is called and rules that all the money should be returned to all players like the hand never happened. One player turns over 4-4, not important, but sucks.
Yeah.
So, was this the correct call, and shouldn't the money been split only by the remaining two players?
Okay. One thing before I read Jody, I think they said that the guy actually said he did see the call, right?
I think I mistyped that, actually.
Oh, okay, because that would make kind of sense, too, later. He's like, I did see the call. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to muck it. I don't know what I was thinking or whatever, but yeah.
Regardless.
But Jody says he would have split the pot among the players who were remaining, sent the dealer home for a few days. Which I love. I love that answer. And it's true. I mean, how could you possibly give money to people who aren't in the pot anymore?
Well, yeah, but they're just giving back the money that they already put in, so it's not like they split it evenly.
No, I know. They wouldn't split the other guy's $20, but they're getting back their money when the hand played out and they made their action according to what happened. The guys who still survive should get the money, right?
I'm not playing devil's advocate.
Oh,
right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
I just want to be sure that people understand that the...
Yeah, they didn't get the other guy's $40.
Right. Well, it wasn't evenly split.
Right.
You put $4 in, you got $4 back.
That makes no sense that they would give them back their money. Oh, that's weird. I have to side with Jody on this one.
Well, I'm not really with Jody. He's a professional.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's. I would have thought that was kind of odd that you just have a magic pill to those little flashy things like on Men in Black.
You take the blue pill.
Hey, wasn't I just being blind? No, you weren't. Okay, great.
That is bizarre. Yeah, that's the other thing, too. If you're returning it back, the hand didn't happen, did they deal it all over again with the blinds in the same spot? I guess they did, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's really weird. That is really weird. And that's the thing, four stands, their ruling stands, and that's like, you got to live with that. That is weird.
Yeah, well, he said, hey, I'll send the dealer home. It might be a little draconian, but it's good to mention because, we still got this ongoing thing on the forum where people seem to think that I'm defending the right for dealers to make as many mistakes as they can, which is not true. Just reminding people they're human and they do make mistakes, so we have to correct them. So
right, that's why we have floors.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
All right, well, our feedback comes from Trevor Smith, Scott's favorite part of the show. And I wondered if you and I had mentioned this idea or not. I can't remember. We had talked about a lot of different scenarios that day, but this it's concerning the micro stakes live thing. We talked about, where all the online players might go. He says he headed to Reno, Nevada for a bachelor party, and he looked up some poker rooms to play in. The Silver Legacy listed on its website that they offer 55-cent dollar games on their poker pro tables. So he said it was just a thought, but rooms that want to attract low-stakes players and not have to pay a dealer to find, whatever, may find these machines suitable. And, of course, I guess those machines are shared on a rake. They get Poker Pro gets some money from the rake. I don't know how it really works out. Or maybe you just buy for the software or whatever. But he said the rake could be low enough so that it won't really hinder the profits of the place that's hosting them and still make a profit for them playing at micro limits. So I wondered if we talked about that. Did we say something like that where you could program them to be whatever we want them to be?
We mentioned a couple of thoughts on that, and I think what his point is here too, by the table, you put it in, you can do whatever you want to it as far as the stakes and stuff. So
right.
You're trying to appeal to those that class of people. All right, not that's the wrong word. The level of player that wants to play them, then you can do that.
Right.
It's possible, but again, remember that these tables take up space.
Right.
In the casino. that could be used for something more profitable. So if you're talking about a game that's generating a nickel rake versus a slot machine that's 5 cents a pull with 100 pay lines.
Right.
You know, there's a cost thing there. So, you know, even though you're not, it certainly makes it easier than not having a dealer there. It depends on tips and things to do it this way. But, the machines are really expensive. I mean, I don't know how much they cost, but I know they're not, you know, you're not going to walk to Walmart and pull it off the shelf.
Next to the plastic bananas.
Yeah, plug it in. You know, so I mean, one, it's taking up the floor spot, which is probably the bigger expense. And then two is the actual expense of buying and licensing in or whatever you do. Yeah. To make it go. So, no, it's a good idea. And obviously, this casino, you know, a 55-cent dollar game, I mean, that's almost unheard of. You know, maybe they're tapping into a market there, particularly in Reno, where, you know, you've got competition for bigger money games there. That's probably an opportunity to have poker in your room that other rooms aren't willing to offer.
And the other thing, too, is there are establishments out there that aren't casinos that don't have to worry about the space. Like in New Hampshire where the charity rooms are, or even here in Florida where there are just card rooms and horse racing or whatever in some of them.
Yeah.
Maybe they have the space or they realize a certain corner of the room really isn't getting filled up with their tournaments or something. But yeah, I would think it would take something like Poker Pro to say, that's the name of the company, right? Poker Pro Tables.
Yeah. Oh, it's Poker Tech as a company. Yeah.
Poker Tech's the company, yeah. So it would take something like the company to say, hey, you know, realize there's an untapped market out there. Maybe we do reduce our fee or our software or something to keep the company going and to keep, you know, and to try a different market or something. So, yeah, I think it's a good idea if it's feasible and the money, you know, for certain situations, too. Like you said, if there a lot of these poker rooms, where they're in casinos, are fighting already as it is with the casino managers to keep their poker rooms open because they think, hey, that space is more valuable for slots. So, you know, for them to say, okay, now we're going to bring in a machine that makes less money and actually, you know, then it's a tough argument.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. I mean, again, it's just an expensive product, even if they make it cheap enough to do. But
yeah,
it's an interesting idea. So
yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
See.
Absolutely. All right, let's see what news is gathering on the Antiup News Desk.
Stephen Levitt, the author of the popular Freakonomics series, has written a new paper with a colleague that says not only is poker a game dominated by skill, Chris, but it's a game that provides a higher ROI than investing in the stock market.
Wow. This just in, the sky is blue.
Yeah.
I love how it hasn't been said until someone says it. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, I'm glad he wrote this and whatever, but it's like we used to have columnists at the Times that, you know, some of these stories would be like 3 weeks old, but they would still write a column about it because if they didn't say it, it hasn't been said yet, you know? I mean, I understand this is, you know, it's a good thing for us to have somebody saying this, but...
Yeah, it helps when you have somebody a little more established outside of the area to do it. And then it was a popular report. There's some other things that, you know, they even quantified it to the skill level in Major League Baseball. So definitely folks should check that out. I mean, Google Freakonomics and Poker, and you'll find the link somewhere and be able to read it. Very interesting.
You remember, too, when the Jets were in the studio that time with us, and I think Karina had told us that they were being interviewed. Maybe it was just her, I don't know, but they were being interviewed for some documentary about the stock market, and poker players have the type of ability to be good stock traders because of that and everything. So I remember – so this theory, too, has been around a long time comparing – you know, the stock market to poker and whatever. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Howard Lederer and Chris Jesus Ferguson, two pros instrumental in the formation of Full Tilt, have resigned from the Poker Players Alliance board. What do you make of that, Scott?
Well, the online chatter is people are happy about it because they always thought that was a conflict of interest to have people who were integral in an online site pushing this. You know, I think it's tough. I mean, because almost all the big pros have some kind of affiliation with. Yeah. With an online site in some format. I mean, obviously, these two are a bigger affiliation than just wearing a patch and having some kind of endorsement deal. But, but you know, obviously, they got to focus on this business. Now, I know Howard was either already retired or pretty close to retired from it. But, you know, if it was their choice, I think they've got to focus on their business. If it was PPA's choice, you know, it might be a strategic thing to let folks know that, you know, hey, you know, we really want to advocate for legal poker, and maybe we need to cut ties with people that were on sites that at least the government considers to be not up and up. I don't know.
Yeah, do you feel like it's okay for these types of people to have sort of smaller roles and not be on the board, though? I mean, obviously we need people who are the face of poker to motivate people who are fans of theirs. You know what I mean? Just because they own the site. I know that there's a lot of people who would be like, hey, Phil Ivey's going to be there at the march, and I'm going to be there. You know what I mean? So it really helps to have somebody who's popular be a part of these things. But I agree the board is kind of high up there.
Well, the PPA has used this several times, you know, bringing these pros to Washington and impressing people with them. So, you know, I don't think that's going to change. But yeah, when you're right, when you're on the level of a board member or an executive director or something like that, it's a little different than just, you know, inviting them along to preach the cause. So,
yeah, absolutely.
All right, and finally, the godfather of poker, Doyle Brunson, has ended his association with the online poker name that bears his name and has asked the site to no longer use his name or likeness.
Well, that's because he's going to be on the dollar bill soon.
That's true. That's true.
So he doesn't want his face or anything to be part of the site because he's going to be on, he's on our currency, man.
Yeah, well, you know, it's unfortunate. I mean, you know, he was mentioning that he just wants to wait for regulation. Yeah. And but it's a tough pill to swallow for the actual site. Now, I mean, how do you? That's a complete rebranding now.
Yeah,
I mean,
not only is
it a losing an endorser, but it's the name of the site, you know?
Yeah. And also, too, they have, like, that Brunson 10 that they were trying to flesh out and get those 10 players that they felt were going to take the site, you know, into the next whatever generation or whatever. And a lot of stuff coming from that. I mean, I'm assuming that, you know, when it does regulate, he'll come back, but he'll probably come back with his own thing then, you know, because I got the feeling that he didn't want to be a part of it anymore anyway. But I don't know if I could be wrong.
Yeah. And we'll see, but very interesting. With we're still just about 6 weeks from Black Friday, and we're still learning new stuff every day.
This is Noah Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
While the poker world has been reeling from Black Friday, casinos along the Mississippi River have been dealing with their own potential catastrophe. The river's level reached heights not seen in 70 years, affecting casinos from Indiana to southern Mississippi. And nowhere has the danger been higher than in Tunica, Mississippi, where casinos have been closed for weeks and are just now starting to reopen. Joining us today to give us a first-person look at the situation and what it means is Antiup's Mississippi Ambassador, Jennifer Gay.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem. We're actually getting ready to go back to work today. So
That's awesome.
That's great. Very happy to hear it coming back that quickly. So, Jen, here's the thing. I guess it's a roller coaster, really, in media coverage has been. For a while, it seemed like the media wasn't covering the story enough. And now that it's finally catching up to it, the casinos are actually cheating the odds and opening this week. So kind of give us an overview on what kind of month it's been for you.
Well, like you said, initially the national media didn't provide any coverage whatsoever. So there was a huge Facebook outreach. It's kind of amazing how technology has enabled that to happen. And everyone kind of pulled together and you know, the word that the casinos were closing, everyone kind of thought it was a joke at first because they've never closed. I mean, not even for, you know, renovations or a couple of days. It's the casinos are one consistent thing in this area. Actually, when there's big storms down south, like Katrina or hurricanes even further east, people kind of flee to the casinos and stay there. They're kind of like the storm shelters, if you will. So when they said they were going to close, it was kind of a big deal, and speculation ranged from, oh, we'll be closed for 24 hours, and then we'll be back, this is no big deal, to, this is catastrophic, we'll be closed for 6 months. No one really knew what to expect.
Man.
And they did a staggered evacuation, and my property, I work for Horseshoe Tunica, my property was the last to close on Monday, May 2nd. I think the earliest were a few days prior to that, and everyone, they took the money out, all the assets, the cards, the chips. They were taken out by SWAT teams and Brinks trucks. It was really kind of like Armageddon in Tunica.
Man.
No one really knew what to expect.
Explain how the flooding happened. Was it just a deluge of rain that caused it, or was it more than that?
Well, it rained a lot here, but it wasn't really what happened here that was relevant. It was the rain up north, because the Mississippi River is kind of the portal for all that is wet going down south.
Right.
So the Ohio River floods into it, and all of the melting from up north, and then just the spring rains, and it kind of came together. And then I think, you know, you mentioned that it hadn't happened in 70 years. Well, in 70 years, there's been a lot of growth and development and impervious surface, concrete, shopping malls. And so the water that normally would have somewhere to go just doesn't anymore. So it came down, and it came down fast. And, you know, initial predictions were that the river was going to go up to flood stage and then minor flood stage and then major flood stage. And in some areas, we actually beat the record from 70 years ago.
Wow.
This was deemed a 500-year flood. It was absolutely catastrophic. And the way the casinos are built down here, they're all on boats, but they don't appear to be boats because the majority of the properties are land-based. The restaurants, the hotels, everything's built on land. The only part that actually floats is the actual gaming floor.
Right.
And these boats were never designed to be boats. They were designed just to meet the gaming regulations. So when the water starts to rise, the casino floor starts to kind of disconnect from the land-based operations, and it allows water into the hotels and the restaurants. The parking lots flood, and then the casinos, you know, 10, 15 feet above the actual land-based operation. So it kind of becomes a disaster. And some of the properties took a significant amount of damage, but we're hoping that everyone will be open by Memorial Day weekend. Most of the properties that are open or opening this week are only partly operational. Gold Strike, for example, which is Horseshoe's neighbor, opened Wednesday at 10 a.m., but their hotel, none of the land-based operations are open, just the gaming floor.
Right.
The parking garage is still under about 15 feet of water, and there's some concern about when the water recedes, what sort of damage will be done, but the hotel is still closed, the restaurants are still closed, so we're opening, but it's still kind of a little weird.
Man.
Well, you know, I grew up in Ohio, and when it flooded, it was like fun for the kids to go out in the street and play, and then it didn't really heard anything. And then I moved to southern Ohio along the Ohio River, and floods were a big deal there. But when they were getting bigger, it seemed like a novelty. People were kind of excited to watch it kind of grow until it got to the point that it actually started doing some damage. Can you kind of take us through the chain of events? Was there morbid curiosity, excitement of the river? And then what happened when it actually got not fun anymore?
Yeah. Actually, it was just like what you said about the kids playing in it. Like the first couple of days when the water starts coming in, and no one really thinks this is going to be a big deal, because the weathermen are somewhat notorious for wanting ratings. And, you know, they're talking about doomsday, and you look out in the parking lot, there's kids playing in the water in the casinos. And, you know, the Mississippi River is not really something that you want to play in. It's not the healthiest water in the world. And, you know, so initially it was kind of fun, and people were taking pictures, and they started putting out notifications that if you go near the levees that you could be arrested, and no one really took that seriously until they started arresting people. And I was actually talking to some of the engineers on the property at Gold Strike, and two of the engineers the night before had taken a boat out and had gone over the levee, and they were taken in by Tunica County. So,
wow.
And I don't think anyone actually, you know, spent a night in jail over it, but it was becoming becoming aware very quickly that this was going to be a big deal. And the third day after the evacuation, Caesars Entertainment sent out internal emails asking for volunteers. And the first day we got 200. I went in, my mom went with me, and we started building sandbag walls. And the walls were about 6 feet tall. And I'd say we did, I don't know, maybe 2 miles of wall, maybe
jeez,
less than that.
Oh,
it was a lot. It went around every part of the facility and every part of the parking lot. And a lot of people kind of saw the efforts that we were doing, because this is before there's any water. And they're saying, wow, they're really overdoing it. I had a friend, he's a poker player down in Biloxi, Mississippi, poker monkey Will Souther. He drove up from Biloxi to help with the sandbagging. He volunteered in Tuscaloosa, and he's aware of how important it is to get involved. So he spent a couple days with me sandbagging, and I was alongside the poker room manager of Harrah's, Steve Reed, and we got a lot done, but we all still kind of thought it was not going to be that big of a deal. And then I would say by the end of the first week, Fitzgerald Casino, the pictures started coming out, and they were almost entirely underwater. You would drive down to Tunica, and there would be tourists everywhere taking pictures, but you couldn't really see a whole lot because security and police had everything blocked off. And the sheriff's department did a great job of providing aerial photos as the water was coming in. And the amazing thing about it was, when it was all said and done, is those walls that we built were the only things that kept the water from getting into Horseshoe Roadhouse and Gold Strike.
Wow.
Our properties didn't take any water on. The water came right up to the walls and rose several feet against the walls, but we were successful in keeping the water out. And I think that the other properties, if they had had more time, probably would have done the same thing, but they were sitting in lower-lying territories, and really they were under within a few days.
God.
Wow.
Well, you know, this is a poker show, so we realize this affected you know, just scores and scores of poker players, but it also affected the dealers and everything. And I know that I've read in your column, which explains a little more of this in detail, about, you know, some players were, or dealers were going to like Biloxi or whatever to try to just find some work, or even down south or whatever. But a lot of people probably lost wages on this too. I mean, can you tell me what the whole feeling was like there? I mean, how painful was it for you to know that? I mean, some of you probably got paid, but you know the situation there, and basically how people were dealing with losing their money and stuff?
Well, it was really scary because at first none of us knew that we were going to be paid. The companies, all of them, I think with the exception of Resorts and Bally's, and I'm not really sure what their arrangements were, but all of the other 8 resorts down there agreed to pay their employees full wages plus tips, which is pretty fantastic.
Awesome.
However, you have to claim your tips for them to have a basis to pay, and I'm not saying that anyone doesn't claim 100% of their tips, but the fact of the matter is it was a major financial hit because dealers who are accustomed to making $300 a day are now drawing their minimum wage plus whatever they've claimed on their taxes. And on top of that, dealers kind of, a lot of them live kind of week to week on the sense of, well, if I need more money, I'll just pick up an extra day.
Yeah.
And that option was eliminated. Fortunately, at least within Caesars, I'm not sure with the other properties, but at least within Caesars, other properties such as New Orleans, Biloxi, St. Louis, even Vegas, were very welcoming. They would take on whoever they could. Transportation was even provided to New Orleans. Other states made accommodations in terms of getting emergency gaming badges or temporary work permits. So we kind of were able to skirt around the red tape that would normally apply. So they did as much as they could. I know that everyone's excited about getting back to work. You know, even the management, people think that the management had it so good. I'm in management. It's the same thing with us. A great percentage of our money comes from tournament percentage, you know, the floor percentage that you pay when you enter a poker tournament.
Yeah.
That's a large percentage of our money is the tokes. So all of us kind of took a hit because if the tournaments aren't going on, obviously they're not taking in that money and we're getting a smaller percentage. And I think we're all excited about going back and getting our pay. From a poker perspective, it's been kind of devastating because, you know, Black Friday happened, I think, the week before this.
Right.
And so we were unusually busy, you know, probably 10 times our normal volume of players. We had this new crop of, like, zombie-looking poker players coming in, and they have no idea that, you know, they can't just make a move and walk away from the table, and we're kind of training them how to play live, and they're finding their home in the live poker rooms, and then that's taken away, too. And all of the poker action was shut down. Southland and West Memphis remained open, but those are electronic tables, and I know that where they typically run, like, 1 or 2 games, they were full every single night. But, you know, there was no poker available in the area. A lot of our promotions and tournaments, we had tournaments that were, you know, ready to put people in the main event in Vegas, and all of those had to be canceled indefinitely. So it's kind of created like a massive backlog of, you know, there's just absolutely been nowhere to play. I'm sure the home games have been doing very well this month.
Well, you mentioned that you were a floor manager at Horseshoe Tunica, and you guys had a big event that was in the middle of this. It wasn't just the World Series, though, right?
Right. No, we were we're not an actual WSOP satellite place, and the reason for that is our facility is built so that our poker room has a limited amount of space on water, and we don't really have a lot of convention space, so everything kind of that scale is held at our sister property, Harrah's. So we don't have an actual satellite, but what we are trying to do is in the spring run a series where if you place top 5 in any of our, you know, 10 or 15 events, then you're entered into a free roll, and those 50 people will compete for a main event package that includes your buy-in and some expenses and whatnot. It's a really great deal, a lot of added value, and we were really excited. we did a lot of promoting. We promoted through Antioch Magazine, and this just killed it. So now the plan is, it's a little late. We realize we can't give away a main event seat and expect people to be able to make it to Vegas and arrange their travel plans. So what we're going to do instead is do a couple weekends of bigger tournaments, a couple of 500-plus buy-ins, and then the winners from those will be entered into a free roll, and we'll add like 5,000 and maybe some other added value. But we don't really know. I mean, we really don't know what the crowds are going to be like. I'm anticipating tonight, that's my first shift back, that we're going to be slammed, because right now there's only two poker rooms open. That's Gold Strike and Horseshoe. And we're looking at another week and a half before Harrah's and Sam's Town and Hollywood, which are the other poker rooms, kind of are back in action. So we're either going to be really, really busy, or, you know, we don't really know what to expect. It's possible that our players are still down in Biloxi and St. Louis.
Wow. Well, you know, you have the distinction of being the first Anti-Up ambassador. And I wanted to know, how are you enjoying that gig? And you also mentioned that some people were giving you some reaction to the column and everything, but what's the overall consensus about what they think about Anti-Up and you being a part of it?
You know, I'm amazed by Anti-Up. I've been in print media a long time, full-time before I was in poker, and this isn't the first poker publication that I have worked with either. And I've worked with some that were, you know, on an international scale. And when I came on board with Anti-Up, it was still relatively small and relatively new. And I thought, well, this will be fun. It'll keep me writing and, you know, it'll be a little hobby. It has snowballed into something tremendous. I mean, I don't think I can walk into any event anywhere without someone coming up and telling me how much they love the magazine. And, you know, if the magazine's 3 days late because of the post office being delivered to the poker room, people want to know why. And feel like that if they could text message or email me personally, that I might have some answers as to what the USPS is up to. But it's tremendous. I'll be in a tournament and, you know, I'll be like at a critical all-in moment and someone will come up and ask me for a patch or ask me what I'm writing about next month. I was down at the IP. This is the best Anti-Up moment so far. I was down at the IP Biloxi last fall. And Jimmy Summerfield was the tournament director for the event, and he's a friend. And he made an announcement, and he said, I want to let you guys know. It was a 345 ring event. And he said, I want to let you know, at table 27, seat 7, there's a columnist from Anti-Up Magazine here named Jennifer Gay, and she's doing a story on bad beats. So while she's here this week, if you would, she'd like it if you'd approach her and tell her your worst bad beat story.
Nice.
And she'll put your name in the magazine.
Very nice.
So, which was entirely fabricated. So for the entire time I was down there, it didn't matter if I was at a restaurant, in a public bathroom, or, you know, at a final table, which fortunately I made, you know, at least one, I was approached nonstop hearing, you know, the most exciting bad beat tales. And to this day, I still, you know, get a ton of emails and messages on Facebook saying, oh, this is what happened to my friend. Would you put his name in the magazine? And obviously we can't work in everyone that emails, but it's been a lot of fun. And the enthusiasm has made it by far the best publication I've ever been affiliated with.
Man, well, we totally appreciate that. That's awesome. I wasn't even expecting that answer. That was just great. I appreciate that.
and I owe Jimmy one for that, by the way. So, but anyone who knows him knows he's kind of a prankster. So, but that was a lot of fun.
Well, it's probably a good opportunity to remind folks that they, too, can become an ambassador by going to antiupmagazine.com/ambassadors and filling out our application. They're looking for folks wherever you live in the United States, as long as we don't already have somebody like great like Jen working for us. We are interested in having you aboard.
I would also just, you know, I would like to encourage everyone. You read about it on the news and you see the pictures and you see Facebook. I know a lot of people have added my Facebook through the magazine and kind of keep up with Tunica happenings there, and I try to keep everyone up to date. But this has been a catastrophic hit for the dealers and for, you know, even the county of Tunica, DeSoto County, Tunica County, and surrounding counties in terms of tax revenue. If you're planning on making a gambling trip or taking a vacation that involves poker, consider coming out to Tunica and showing some support, because, you know, there's a lot of places that you can choose to spend your dollars. This is one area where we always go above and beyond to take care of our guests and make sure that you have a great time. But, you know, we need the support right now. We've been shut down for almost a month, and we would like to see some record-breaking numbers to kind of help get everyone back on their feet.
Absolutely. That's a great point.
Thanks again, Jen. We really appreciate it. Have fun tonight in your first shift back, and keep writing great columns for us.
All right. Thank you. Thank you guys so much.
Okay. Take care.
Hi, this is Clooney Gowan, and you're listening to Annie Up.
Badoogie, baby!
Badoogie, oh my God. Have we ever had a badoogie in other than like maybe talking to it, talking about it with
Raymer?
Raymer? Yeah, I'm trying to remember.
I don't know whether we.
I know we've had triple draw. I can't remember if we have a badoogie. You know, it's hard when you do 500 shows to remember every game, but I'm pretty sure.
I'm drawing a blank on remembering doing a badoogie hand in the past. So I'm excited that our friend Drunko 666 sent in to us. He obviously is a swag runner, so he doesn't need swag for it. But he's brand new to the game.
Yep.
And fully admits that he sucks heads up at it, which is great because he's giving us a license to just brutalize him on the show. this came up in the Papes, you know, the little listener series, the Play Money series on PokerStars, that it's mimicking the Rest in Peace Apes for this year.
Yes.
And it was Badoogie this last week, and he was playing it, and he sent us a hand. That's great because it gets us to explain Badoogie. And also, amazing little short stack ninja discussion that we'll have at the end of this.
I can't wait to hear this. All right, so we'll tell everybody what Badoogie is in case they don't know.
Yeah, we should probably do that. All right, Badoogie is a low ball draw game.
Yep.
So every player is dealt four cards to begin with, and it's played with blinds, small blind and big blind normally. It's generally limit, but it can also be played pot limit. I assume it could be played not limit, no limit too, but I've never seen it that way.
Right.
The object is to get the four lowest cards as possible in all four different suits.
Right, and ace is low in this game.
Ace is low, and pairs are bad. Obviously, straight is not bad, because you went the best hand is a 4-3 deuce ace.
Right.
Four different suits. But flushes are bad, because if you get two different suits, it isn't.
Right.
And if you don't happen to have four cards in all four suits, which happens often.
Yes.
Then it goes to what's called a three-card badoogie, and you take your three lowest cards of different suits. And if you happen to have only two suits, then wow, don't know why you're still in the hand. And then it goes to a two-card badoogie and such. So a king, queen, jack, 10 true badoogie is better than an ace, deuce, tray, three-card badoogie.
Yeah, or ace, deuce, tray, ace, deuce, tray, four, right. Only two different suits or three suits. So, yeah, anything that's a true badoogie wins over something that's not a true badoogie. So
excellent. And it's a great game to call. I like it a lot, particularly because it gets Chris on tilt.
I just fold.
So I just sit there. If I'm like, you know what? Hey, Chris is getting all hat B over there. His stack's getting big. You know what? I'm going to call badoogie. Level the playing field here a little bit. Not that I'm better at Badoogie than you or not, but I just know you hate it more than I do. So.
And the players now listening to the show know that you have become the ass in our game. I've handed that title over to you, so they don't expect anything less than you than to just try to piss me off for no reason. It's
all strategic. all right, well, this comes from Papes, as we mentioned, so it's a tournament Badoogie hand, and it is a limit. And we must be pretty far down because it's just four-handed here. Blinds are 150, 300. And have a fold. Okay.
No, I was just going to say, so the blinds are, you know, stacks are pretty decent, right? So the blinds, are they going to come in there?
Yeah, we're looking at our hero here is a short stack with 1,500 in chips.
Okay.
Another player of a 1,650. Second place is 3,385, and the ship leader has a whopping 11,400 in chips.
Okay, so really, if you're going to pick a hand as the hero, you're going to want to pick a hand that you can go with, because
it's
three draws, and it's going to cost you three and six and six, and you only have 1,500. So
yeah, to limp, it's going to be fifth of your stack. To raise, it's going to be
a little less than
almost half. Yeah. And then you know, after that, you've got Three draws in this game, too, which we didn't mention, too. So there's a round of betting before you draw, and then there's a round of betting after every draw.
Right. For those of you who play triple draw, it's the same yeah. triple draw betting pattern, so, or structure. Where are we seated?
Okay, we are on the baton.
Excellent.
And the under the gun player, who is the other short stack, folds. And we look down at the eight of diamonds, the ace of diamonds. See, I like that when they're both the same.
Yes.
Because then people don't have to figure out which one I'm saying. I'm saying them both. So eight of diamonds, ace of diamonds, deuce of spades, ten of clubs. What do you do?
Well, the ace deuce is really powerful. I would raise and then just go with this hand.
You've decided you're going to take a stand with this hand.
Yeah, I mean, unless the other thing too is you could try to just get a regular Badoogie to get in your hand, and whether it's a king high or not, and then just not draw at all and hope that nobody makes a Badoogie. But really, if I'm going to come into the pot in Badoogie, I'm going to come in for a raise, and this is a playable hand, so I'm probably going to raise with this hand, and I'm probably just going to keep the 10 too. By the way, ace deuce is really powerful, but I'll keep the 10, I think, and then if I happen to draw a lower club, I'll throw it away. But I may, if I get a re-raise, I may end up definitely keeping the 10 because I want to make sure that this person's drawing, and if they are, then I don't know. I'm just, right now, I'm going to keep those three cards and raise.
Wow, we're building this up to be an epic hand of the week. I love it. All right, so you're going to raise here. All right, here's kind of what my thought is here. I am raising here to steal the blinds.
Oh, yeah, if I can.
Because the ace-deuce is nice, but, you know, I'm going to have to definitely throw away the 8 because it's suited. You know, if I'm drawing to a 10, not great, but it could win. I mean, we're four-handed, so it might win. Right. But really, if I'm going to raise here, I want to steal the blinds. So I guess my thinking is if all I'm trying to do is steal the blinds and I'm this short-stacked, maybe I'm going to take a pass on this. So if I was deeper, then I would definitely race with this every time in this position to try to steal the blinds. But I don't want to get committed to this hand, I don't think, and put 600 of my 1,500 in now and then obviously have to probably put more in.
Well, I think that this hand is too good to pass up four-handed when one's already folded and all you have are the blinds behind you. Plus the fact that your stack is so short that if you are committing 600, they know no matter what, it's probably going to cost you another 900.
That's an important part, yes.
If they're thinking that, and then even at that point, you know, they can't get away from their hand because, you know, if you're going to call this raise, you can't fold for 900 or another 300 later. So ultimately, I think this is a good enough hand to go with, to be honest with you, especially when I only have the blinds behind me and they know I'm committed. So I could steal the blinds that way, and if I don't, I'm happy with my three card right now, and I got three draws to try to make a better ace deuce three hand. So I don't mind the raise if he raises, and if he calls, that's the problem, I think. I don't think a call is the right move here.
You put a gun to my head, I could defend a call, but I certainly wouldn't advocate it. You know, if you're calling, it's because you're in between the two of us right now.
Right.
But, you know, you've already decided that this is a hand that you're going to go to the mat with, which is perfectly fine. A lot of people would agree with it. I'm like, I don't know whether this is a hand I want to go to the mat with. So by limping, you know, you're putting just 300 in, and maybe, you know, you draw. You know, it's very weak, but I could see someone doing it. But I'm not advocating it at all.
So. In a cash game, I might just call, just because I have position, you know, whatever. And I'm not.
Well, that's
you know,
an interesting point. Yeah, you know, that's actually very interesting. Yep.
But if it's a tournament like this, and I'm trying to win money, not pots, I'm gonna raise. So.
All right. Well, that's exactly what our hero did. He's going for the pot and the money.
Yes.
Raises 100. Small blind gets out of the way. The big blind, who remember, is the big stack, calls.
Right.
All right, so our steal attempt was foiled, but at least we're heads up. We're in position with a three-card 10.
Yeah.
Not a bad spot.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, again, you get in three draws. You could easily draw a lower club. You could easily make your hand. You know, all kinds of things can happen. Plus, if this person throws away more cards than us, then we know we're ahead, and we could literally just get any heart and be happy, you know, because he's still drawing. So, and if he's drawing more than us, that means he's drawing at least two, and we're a huge favorite if we make our hand on the first draw. So I'm happy with just throwing away the 8 and trying to make my hand.
Well, you know, and the other thing, too, we had to think about, you know, we were talking before about raising and people thinking that, hey, this hand's going to end up costing me $15.55.
Right.
And that works with all two of the people left in the, or two of the people at the table, but the big stack probably doesn't really care so much. You know, if he loses $1,500 on this, he is down to $10,000 and still has a 3-to-1 ship lead over second place.
Right.
You know, so unfortunately, we're in an unfortunate spot to try to steal there. But I think we had to, and we got called, so now we got to play it up.
Okay, what do we get? Or what happens? What happens, actually?
All right, so our villain in this hand discards two cards.
That's good.
It's on us. What do we do?
Well, here's the deal. I think I keep the 10 anyway. I mean, I could throw away the 10 now, knowing that if I do, I still have the best hand, because by him throwing away 2, he can only have the same hand as me, you know, as far as ace deuce. So, I don't know. I think I still keep the 10, because him throwing away 2, I'm still trying to make a Badoogie, ultimately, and then I can make a really good 3-card Badoogie if it works out that way, so... There's a little part of me that says I could throw away the 10 now because I'm even with this guy, but I'm actually ahead and I have position on him the rest of the way. But I'm telling him with my raise that I probably have a 3-card, good 3-card already, so I want to keep that story going and just throw away the 8. So, throw away the 8. So I think that's what I do.
All right, so you're going to throw away the 8.
Yeah. What would you do?
Excellent!
Because you wouldn't. You'd throw away the 10 and the 8, too, right?
You played right into this here. And I'm not picking on you, and I'm not picking on our hero here, but I think this is the fundamental problem in this hand, is that we threw away just one card here.
Yeah.
This is a classic spot where we should have stood pat.
Yeah, I was going to say, you say pat. I wondered if you might say pat there.
And here's why. We raised preflop. I mean, obviously, somebody might think, hey, they're just trying to steal, which is what we were trying to do. I short stacked, but the fact that we're short stacked knows that, hey, we're committed to this. So we raised, we showed aggression, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then our opponent throws away 2 cards.
Right.
Now remember, this is a 4-card game, folks.
Yeah.
If your hand is only 50% good, that's failing.
I love the way your voice kind of like did the prepubescent crack there. That was great.
But it's true. It's failing. You know?
I know.
If you get a 3-card hand, it's a 75%. He's trying. He's got potential. We'll put him in remedial summer school. He'll come back.
I just don't want to back myself into a situation where now I have to throw away a card at the end because he's made his hand too.
But I mean, here's the thing. He's got three draws. You have 3 draws. There's no reason to get frisky right now. He's drawing 2 cards. He's saying, you know what? I got a lot of chips. I don't care. I'm going to take 2 cards. If you stand pat here, you're sending him a very, very strong message. My hand is made. Or if you think I'm bluffing, it's going to cost you to find out. You're drawing 2 cards. That means your hand is crap. So good luck. If you don't, if this hero does not hit both of those cards, I don't think he can continue the rest of the hand.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it is interesting that if he bets 300 now, staying pat, and the other guy improves by 1 card, he's going to call 300. And now he's drawing, and then you stay pat again. Now you've wasted 2 draws, and it's only 600. He's getting pot odds to call, and like you say, he's got the huge stack, and it's not going to bother him anyway. It's only going to call him 600 to get 1 more, and then if that happens, it's less than 300 on the last call, even if he has a good 3-card hand. You know what I mean? You could be bluffing. And how many times out of 10 will you bluff? And if he thinks that's the right percentage, he may call in the end with a 3-card hand. So I see what you're saying, and I agree. It is a good place to do it, I think. But I think you might have to have more chips to pull that off successfully every time or whatever. You know what I'm saying? I feel like it's tough.
Yeah, I'll give you the fact that the chip stack is not in our favor here.
Right.
But remember, it's triple draw, so we do have that Hail Mary insurance policy.
Right.
If this guy is stubborn and keeps drawing, that on the end, we could ditch 2 cards and hope to hit big. And even hitting 1 might be good. We never know. We have to see how the hand plays out. But, you know, this isn't. If this is a single draw, it's different.
Right.
A little bit, I think. But no, we have that insurance policy, so I don't want to use that insurance policy. I don't like just writing that check to that Geico every month just for the fun of it. I like to know that it's there, that I'm paying that money cause, so it's there to protect me if I get in trouble.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing as Triple Draw here. I mean, let's not waste the money, that quote-unquote money that we're investing to have those three shots.
Yeah.
Let's play this strong now, and if you know, if the wheels come off the wagon, then great. We still have a shot at, on the third draw to salvage it. But right now, I think the best thing is to stare down our opponent and say, "Hey, you can keep drawing at me all you want, but you're gonna have to outdraw me."
Now, this is the tough part with the hand of the week, and I bring this up a lot because it's tough. Because let's say you did stay pat,
mm-hmm.
Now you have to. We have to react to what the hero does now, who doesn't stay pat, probably, because otherwise you already said that he didn't. So I don't know how you do that. You know, I mean, I don't know. Now we go through the hand, and you're saying, I would have stayed pat, but you're going to get to know what this guy does with your pat. And we don't know what he would have done had you stayed pat in the real hand.
True. That's very true.
It's tough.
But, you know,
we
can't do that. So, I mean, we'll have to do the best we can. But
So I kind of agree, though. I kind of agree that a pat is a great plan of attack. I do. I think it's a good plan of attack. I wish we had more chips to do it with, but I do think it's a good plan of attack. Me, though, I still think I would throw the 8 away. And
I'll go a step further here, too. I think the 1 card is the weakest move here. I say
one.
If you're drawing, he's drawing 2 cards. Let's just get rid of the 10, too. If we're going to try to outdraw him and make this a drawing contest, then let's be as powerful as we can. We got 2 to the nuts. Let's not have this this ugly sister hanging around here. It's clean to the decks, and let's try to draw better. And we got 3 draws to improve on that 10. Let's not go halfway here.
Well, so to me, I understand what you're saying, and I know we're ahead. I know we're ahead because we have ace deuce if we do that anyway. But
because what's going to happen if you only draw 1 and he comes out firing or he stands pat? You can't feel confident that your 10's good at that point. There's a lot of times that you feel confident in this game with a 10 high Badoogie, but not when somebody else is showing some sort of strength. Right?
Well, here's the thing, though, is if you throw 2 away, now he's going to feel like any improvement, now he could be ahead and he might bet into you anyway. And then what do you do when you draw ace-deuce again and you got no hand?
That's why you stand pat.
Right, exactly, Scott. That's the problem with these hands
of the
week.
To me, the stand pat is the 75% preferred play here. And then the other 2 divide up the other 25.
Well, you know as well as I do how difficult it is to actually make up a doogie. This is not like deuce to 7 where
absolutely
pretty much any hand makes it.
And that's part of what's going on in my thought here. Is this guy's drawing 2? That means he's starting with crap to begin with. Now he's got to go 3 draws to get up a doogie, which is really hard to do anyhow. Well, let's just stand pat. Let's make him do all the work. We're in position. We don't have to worry about it. If we're out of position, completely different situation. But we can react to absolutely everything our hero does here.
Well, the problem, though, is that you were giving 75% credence to a bluff, and I'm assuming you were going to give 25% credence to throwing 2 away and 0 to throwing 1 away. I don't agree with that. You have 75% of good made hand already.
I'm giving 5% to a 5 or 10.
All right. So let's say you're giving me 10% on my move. I think that I have a 75% made Badoogie hand in a game that is very difficult. I would normally raise with a 3-card Badoogie, which is what he did. So I'm continuing that story. And I would throw 1 away versus his 2, so he knows I'm ahead. I know he's behind. I could very well stay pat on the next one no matter what I get.
You know,
I mean, I wouldn't give 75% credence to bluffing and, you know, 15%
to throwing 2
away.
Well, that's why I'm better at the Badoogie than you are.
Yeah.
But no, we're not going to belabor this too much longer. But again, for folks that are new to the game, the one thing that I think is really hard for people to understand is that the only information you get in this game is from the bet size and the number of draws.
Right.
There are no community cards. The community cards totally change the complex of a hand. I mean, you still don't know the whole cards of people, but you can watch how the hand develops based off of that, and it's really confusing. I mean, in this game, that's the only information you get. So I'm telling, it's not so much a bluff here. I mean, it is a bluff, obviously. It's not so much a bluff. It's just it's a power move here, I think.
Well, my question then is,
I'm responding to, if he drew 1 card, it's a different story. If he stood pat, obviously a different story. He's drawing 2 cards. So I got to tell him, you know, hey, and I caught you. You're really weak. I'm really strong. Good luck. And I really don't think that our villain can continue in this hand unless he hits two good cards. By us standing pot. By us showing him that we're a little bit weak, that opens the door to a lot more possibilities for him. I mean, we'll see how it goes. I mean, but...
Okay, well, let's go to what happened now. So we drew one, right?
Yeah, we threw away the eight of diamonds.
Okay, what did we get?
And we got the nine of clubs.
All right, so we improved, but incrementally, obviously. Okay, well, what does the villain do?
He checks to us. And okay, see, well, this is exactly what I'm talking about. He missed. And we stood pat. Now we fire a bet here. He really, unless he's just really sniffing out a bluff here or just doesn't care, he can't continue in this hand. But the fact that we drew one, it makes our story a little harder. Now, obviously, we drew one too, so now maybe we caught and we're betting. So it still might work, but it's far more powerful had we stood pat, I think.
Well, the other thing, though, is that if he – the standard play in this game when you're behind and out of position is to check no matter what. So he could be check-raising us here and made his hand. If you stayed pat, he could check-raise you. You don't know what's coming. So really, I understand that you're saying he missed, but that is not the case in this game. Triple draw games, standard play is to – sometimes you don't even look at your card you check because that's just the way it goes. He asked position. He knew how many you took. He could be check-raising you because he knows you're going to bet because you've been strong the whole time. So I don't know if I agree with if I stayed pat and he checks to me that he's weak. He could literally have a better pat hand. So
you're
I don't know.
I got ahead of myself here. He checked, we bet, and he just called.
Okay, he called.
All right, so now that we know that, then we know he's not check-raising.
Right, okay. Well, you could still try your staying pat here, I guess, because now you could get the ruse that you made your hand. But since he's already invested another 300...
Right, but we can't make that decision until we know what he does. Again, that's what's important here. When I'm playing this game, I'm always... Not that I'm not formulating a plan for the hand, because I am.
Right.
But a lot of this, particularly when I'm in position, I'm making my response based off of what I see from my opponents.
Right.
They're telling me what they're doing, and I have the ultimate power position. Because position is no more important than any game... than this game, I think.
Right.
In these draw games, because they really have to show what they're doing.
Well, all right, so what happens then? So they said the guy called, so now how many does he throw away?
He throws away one now.
All right, well, so you think a bluff now is out of the question?
Now he's improved one. He's got one good card. Now I think we have to fight him on a draw.
Yeah.
Which is fine because you know our nine could be good. We have two draws now. We throw the card away twice, and a nine could be good. And if he stands pat on the next draw, then we know that we're going to have to throw two away to improve it, which is fine. But we gave up so much power in this hand.
So you think that if he stood pat at any point now, and you had a three card nine, you would throw the nine away? You don't think he'd stay pat with a jack? Or a 10, or a queen, or a king, when you're still drawing?
Well, he could, but that's a tough decision that we found ourselves in.
Right. I'm just saying, before you said that if he stays pat, we have to throw away two cards. I wouldn't throw away two. I would still just throw away one. A nine Badoogie, I think, might still win when he stays pat on a second draw.
True. I mean, but again, I mean, it's forcing us into a weird situation where we really have to think in a hand, whereas...
Before
we didn't have to. So, I mean, it doesn't mean that we're going to make a mistake or that we can't do something different. We just lost a little... the hand was easy for us, playing
right.
my way.
Right, you lost control and strength by drawing and not hitting your hand and drawing again. All right, well, so this guy draws one, you said. So now we have to draw is what you're saying. And you're saying to draw... I would throw the 10 away now and still draw the 9.
Yeah. And that's exactly what our hero did. Okay. And we picked up the 7 of spades.
Yeah, blank.
Does not help us.
Does not help us at all. And we'll explain why. Because it pairs our spade, and the other spade we have is already lower.
That's true.
So that doesn't do any good for you. So
still got a 9-card Badoogie, and if we're going to draw again, we have to, hopefully hit a heart. The villain checks again to us. So now here's a seminal moment in this hand, I think. We decided from the beginning that we were going to go to the mat with this.
Right.
does your mind change now, again, because we're in position here? I mean, we could save a $600 bet here by checking.
I definitely think we can get away with checking here. I mean, I know that we talked about going with it, but I also assume that we might actually make a better hand after two draws than we have and could go with it. But since I don't have to go with it, yeah, I mean, I guess I could save 600, and then if I bet that 600 on the end, I'd still have 300 for a blind later. I mean, I don't know, or I could check again on the end if he checks me and misses. Maybe have showdown value, win the pot, and if not, I still have 900 or so, 950. I don't know. I guess it's 900 or so, but that's a good point. I don't feel like I have to bet here. I think that since I threw away one and he threw away one now, I don't think a bet makes him fold, so...
We're in a situation here where I really don't think a bet is warranted here.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to fold for one more bet now that you guys are drawing.
Yeah, good. I'm not harping back on what I've done before. I'm playing the way he did now. The guy is one card away from what he thinks is a good hand. At this point, we got to outdraw him. At that point, a bet here is not going to get this guy to fold now. So it's just getting money in the pot. As short stacked it is, let's just check here, draw, hope to hit our hand, and win that way. We got to do a little chip protection here, or tournament survival, I should say, not chip protection. Survival here.
The
$600 bet is wasted, I think.
The other thing too is that I'm forgetting now though. He only has 650 left or so.
655.
Yeah, so there is no money to save. So I mean, as far as the next street, it wouldn't be 300 left. It would still. He's betting almost all of his money now if he bets here. Yep. So, Now that it's 600, I guess I could save that money. I guess that's enough for like.
Well, think
one
about
more
this.
Race.
I mean, and this is going to become. I'm not trying to fast forward here, but it's going to become more pronounced on the after the third draw. But think about it now. If you save a bet here, and we miss, and he bets out. And our opponent bets out 600 here. Guess what? We're not going out on this hand.
Right.
Even if we call that 600, we still got 55 left.
Right.
But if we bet it now and our opponent bets, we got to put the 55 in whether we hit or not and hope that our hand is best. To me, it's real critical here not to put this money in. If we hit our hand on the next draw, we're still going to get that 600 in and maybe get the whole 655 in. Woohoo! But right now, let's just save the 600. Until our hand is really strong. Because this is how we got ourselves in this hand. If we were standing pat, I'd be firing the 600 right now without question.
Right.
But we weakened our position, and now we've got to play old damage control and protect our survival in this tournament and check here, take our draw, and hope we hit.
Yeah, especially since we only have 650 left. Would you say 655? Since we only have 655 left. Yeah, maybe it's a definite check now. I was thinking that, I wasn't keeping track of the money well enough that it was 300 left. I thought it was 300, and it's not. So, yeah, I think a check is in order here. But if we did bet and he called, then, we're basically grasping at straws and hoping to God that he has no hand.
Yeah, I mean, we're still trying. We're still going to have to, we're still throwing our seven of spade away, no matter what we do here, right?
Yeah.
And we're still hoping to hit a heart. But the 600 here, it's just, I mean, that's a massive bet to be making on a draw.
Yeah, in relation to your stack.
No fold equity. I mean, the guy's not going to fold to this. He's going to call, and he's going to draw because he knows it's going to cost him 55 on the next. He's only drawing one.
Right.
If he's still drawing two at this point, a bet might get him to fold here, but he's drawing one.
Yeah.
Save that money.
Yeah. And so you think 655 is enough to move on to the next hand if we are fortunate enough to get to showdown and lose.
It's immaterial how much we have. What's material is that we still are alive in the tournament.
So,
and the fact that the 600 that we're betting now isn't going to do anything.
So flashback an hour and a half ago to the show when it was immaterial the guy had 40 grand on the side and we're still alive. That doesn't matter. But here it does matter, right?
No, I said it doesn't matter at all. Absolutely does not matter.
Well, he was still alive in the game back then, so now we're still alive here in the poker tournament. It's kind of the same argument.
But again, the argument is 40,000 versus 100,000.
Yeah.
It's the same thing here. We're 655 versus 55.
Yeah. All right, well, I agree with the check, though.
The difference here is that the 600 does nothing for us. we're going to get that in on after the third draw if we have a good enough hand. So it's not like, oh, Scott, you got to get the money in so you can you get the 600 from him. Well, that's going to happen on the third draw if we hit our hand.
Right.
Or even if we don't hit our hand, we might decide, hey, we need the pot so big we got to call. Right now, we don't need to put it in.
So
it's going to get in the next one.
If you're positive that it won't induce a fold, then the bet is useless, is what you're saying.
Absolutely useless.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I agree. I agree.
Right, so on the third draw, he could bet into us. We can call. We can get our hand, and we could bet 600. It doesn't change the action at all.
Did we say?
But we're giving ourselves a freedom here.
Did we say what he did? I can't remember.
He bets now.
He does bet.
It's bet and call.
And called.
Yeah,
that's tough. That's tough. But now you got to hit.
But you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. You're absolutely right that the unless you're positive it's gonna. If he had drawn two, I would bet because then it's a chance it'll fold. But by drawing one and knowing we drew one, he thinks he could think he's still ahead now, and he's not going to fold for 600. So
vastly different if we have 1,200, because that's a whole other bet on the third draw, and if we feel like we hit our hand, that's going to really help our chips in this tournament. Well, we got 55 behind.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking we had 955 total. So
yeah.
No, that's right. I would definitely
absolutely
check.
No reason to make this bet now.
Yeah, I would check.
All right, so we made the bet. He called third draw. Our villain discards a card. And, of course, we discard ours. We pick up the eight of spades.
Boo.
Do not approve throughout this. Well, we approve slightly throughout this hand. But, yeah. And our villain checks. What do we do?
Oh, man. Well, I mean, I guess there's really no reason to put the 55 in because what's the point? I mean, you're only going to get 55 more out of this guy if you're lucky. And I would just check and hope my three card nine is good.
See, the universe has come together now. We started on polar opposites, and now we're a team again.
Well, we were kind of. Well, yeah, I guess you're right.
Why would you, in your right mind, put your last 55 into this pot right now?
Yeah.
What are you hoping to gain by that?
Yeah. I mean, really. I mean, another 55 units isn't going to help you.
We're in position. We can check behind here. If we win the hand, great. We get a lot of chips. If we lose, we're still alive, Chris.
Yeah. Yep.
We put that 55 in, and he calls, which he will, and we lose, we're out of the tournament. Now, granted, 55 chips is not great. There's nothing to celebrate about it other than the fact that you're still alive.
Yep.
Absolutely no reason to put this 55 in.
This is an S factor of, like, 1.3.
Right. And I dare any of our listeners to write in and tell me why they should put the 55 in here.
Oh, man, that was... You threw it down, buddy.
I do. And I know some will, and they'll all be wrong. So just letting you know now, when you write me and say, hey, this is why I put the 55 in, you're wrong. You're wasting your time. But I encourage you to do it.
Oh, man. Yeah, I totally agree. There's no reason to put 55 in here. Just hope your ace, deuce, nine is good. And it's probably not, but... Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but this is, you know, it goes back to the whole short stack ninja thing. And again, there's weaknesses in my argument, but this is what I'm talking about. You're thinking about, you got to think about your position and in the hand, in the tournament, and just to say, hey, Scott, I'm aggressive. I need to put my chips in. That's a terrible argument.
Yeah.
Survival needs to have some credence in your thought at some point. You can dismiss it if you decide, you know what, hey, the chances of me chipping up and improving are better than survival. Yeah, that's great. And we can argue about that. But here, clearly, hold on to this 55. You're in the tournament. You never know what's going to happen after that.
Do you think, now, again, we didn't play it this way, so it's hard to know what the villain would have done, but do you think if our hero had followed our line of thinking and checking after the second draw, that the villain may now bet out, and it's enough to scare you because you have only 655 left, and he could be bluffing at that point, and then you got to take that consideration?
Possible. Could. I would think most people in that situation would say, hey, this guy's put so much money in this pot, he's just going to throw it in.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I'd really take a shot at bluffing, if that's what you're saying, that the villain might do. But yeah, it changes the dynamic, surely.
All right. Okay. All right. So what happens?
Our hero puts a 55 in the pot, Chris.
Wow. He's a banana winner, right? So we can't really pick on him too much.
We can't pick on him for this reason, because the villain folds.
No way. For 55 chips, the guy folds and won't even show down his three-card hand?
31.50 in the pot, he folds for 55.
He's getting 601-1 on his money or something like that. Wow.
All right, and I tell you what really burns my toast about this.
But 60-1
is I just spent all this time trying to tell people why to save this 55. And now this guy folds to it. And now all the emails are going to say, see, Scott, there's a reason. You never know. The guy might be silly enough to fold to 55.
It was like 61-1 on his money for 55 chips, and he has like 10,000. And he folds. Wow. That's crazy. Both moves are crazy.
Yeah. And of course, we have to say here, the guy's going to fold to a better 55 on the end. Had we just checked, clearly we're going to win with our three-card nine here.
Maybe.
We have to assume. I don't even know what I'd have to assume the opponent had here. You know, if he's still drawing one, you would think he at least has a three-card king, right?
Yeah.
And I can't imagine he's only drawing one with that. So, I don't know. But
man, that's crazy. That is crazy.
Now, when I gave my little short stack on the short stack ninja on the soapbox speech back to our hero here. He said, oh, hey, there's no way I'm saving chips here. I'm going to the wall here. I play to win, not to survive. All right, that's fine. That's great. That's a great attitude to have. But in this situation, you're not playing to win anymore.
Right.
Those extra 55 chips you extract from your opponent there will do nothing to help you win this tournament.
Man, that is crazy.
But the fact that you save them will possibly help you cash in this tournament. And maybe even win. You never know what's going to happen.
Yep.
Massive odds. And remember, think about this, too, in the situation, too. We're on the button right here. Four-handed, and we get a free look at the next hand.
Yep. I was just going to say that. Yep.
You could throw it away. In fact, I probably would. With 55 chips, I would throw almost 98% of the hands that I was dealt away.
Just a made Badoogie is probably all I would keep.
And even a made Badoogie I would probably fold in, unless it was a really good one, only because we only got 55 left. You never know. If you get two other people tangled up in a hand, one of them can knock out. I don't know what the payout is on this. I mean, that'd make a big decision. I mean, if it's only paying one or two, then that's a completely different story. But if it's paying three, you better believe I'm going to hope that somebody gets two dealt Badoogies to people and they raise, re-raise, fight, and one of them gets knocked out. And then guess what? I just cash with 55 units.
Right.
For doing nothing but being smart and paying attention to what's going on.
Yeah. Wow, I can't believe somebody folded for 55 when there was $3,000 out there. That's just unbelievable. Wow, interesting hand. No, but I think that your tactic would have worked, obviously. Of course, we don't know what the cards a guy would have gotten had we... Right, so there's no way to know, but...
It's true.
But I do like the staying pat idea. I just felt like 75% of my hand made, you know, it might be a lot of... There's a lot of things I can do with that if I, you know, but... I think your line of play, too, does make it more powerful and a lot easier to play, you know, because there's really no thought process in it until the end. If he stays pat another draw, then we'd make a decision. But other than that, really, there's no thinking involved. Just keep throwing the chips out there and not taking cards. So interesting way. Maybe I should have read the hand to you.
All right, Drunko, we appreciate you sending the hand of the week, and a very fascinating one, too. And you, of course, got plenty of swag already there at Drunko Headquarters. But everybody else, send your hand of the week to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, and we'll be happy to send you something wonderful like a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antiup store at antiupstore.com.
Okay, so remember my random thought, everybody. Who would you put on the dollar bill, the $5 bill, that kind of thing? Who would you put on your money from the poker world? I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.
Yeah. By the way, Scott, I'm loving the updates of the cats. They're pretty fantastic.
They're certainly energetic.
Yeah. So are they turning out to be as much fun as you thought they would be?
Oh my god, they're 40 times more fun than I thought they would be. So I was telling Krista, I actually work outside now because they just like hanging out on the porch, and you know, one of them is going to fall in the pool at some point, so I got to wait until they actually do, so they're scared of it. So I'm working outside watching them.
My mom has a farm, a big farm, and lots of critters. And what we always do when we get a new animal is we take the animal. This sounds cruel, but you take it by the scruff of the neck, and you go over and you dip it in the pool. And then you show it where the stairs are in the pool, and the animal's going to hate you for like 15 minutes, but then they forget about it. Okay. But the reason that you want to show them where the stairs are is so that when they do fall in, they know how to get out, because animals are actually really smart. So, like, we'll always go over and take the cat or the dog, or we even put a llama in once, and kind of, you know, get it wet and then drag it over to the stairs and let it crawl out itself. And then that way you kind of empower it to escape.
That's how my mom taught me to swim.
Pretty much that's what she did to me too.
Yeah, she shoved my head in the pool and then showed me the stairs. And that was it. She now leave me alone for the rest of the summer, she said.
And Chris isn't smart at all.
And you didn't drown. So
no, I mean, that explains the brain damage, though. I mean,
right. Well, you know, you got to take some losses. It's going to happen.